and come forward with proposals. We will announce further details on student finance for the 2025-2026 academic year in due course. That was that.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
Nikki Campbell.
The voice of the UK.
End of life care. Your experience. Janie Godley, one of the very funniest and the very nicest, has revealed she is now receiving end of life care. I've done a couple of podcasts with her and the sides split long after the mics have closed. She's a one-off. 63 years old from Glasgow and living with cancer, recently been receiving palliative care in a hospital, will now go into a hospice. Very personal video. She said she couldn't take any more and that it's difficult to speak about. She's now wanted to thank those who have cared for her, from doctors and nurses, Macmillan team, and the cleaners on the wards, everybody. She says, it's devastating news to know that I'm facing the end of life, but we all come to an end sometime. And she went on to thank those who had supported her and her family. Now, obviously, an extremely emotional, difficult time for families in this position. Maybe it's something you are navigating right now or have done recently or less recently. Maybe you're in good health at the moment, but thinking about it, drawing up a plan. So I want to tap into what end-of-life care is like in Britain today. All corners of these islands, the options available, the personal decisions people make. End-of-life care, your experience.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Call free 08085 909 693. Text 85058. Text will be charged at your standard message rate. Message on WhatsApp 08085 909 693. Visit bbc.co.uk/5liveterms for our terms of use and privacy notice.
And here's the news from Dina Campbell.
Thank you, Nikki. The Lebanese Prime Minister Najib Mikati has welcomed calls from the UK and other major Western and Arab nations for an immediate 21-day ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah. It's hoped it will give time for further talks aimed at ending the conflict across the Israel-Lebanon border. Meanwhile, the Israeli military says it has hit around 75 Hezbollah targets in southern Lebanon and the Bekaa region overnight. The Met Police says an 18-year-old man has been charged with murder after a schoolboy was stabbed to death in southeast London. 15-year-old Dejean Campbell died from his injuries after being attacked in Woolwich on Sunday. An independent think tank has suggested a radical overhaul of student loans and university funding in England to make the system fairer. The Higher Education Policy Institute wants to see better maintenance support and a national insurance charge for graduate employers. The BBC understands that Elon Musk has not been invited to the government's International Investment Summit next month because of social media posts he made during the recent riots. The billionaire has responded on his platform X by saying that he doesn't think anyone should go to the UK when they're releasing convicted paedophiles in order to imprison people for social media posts.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
On digital radio.
On BBC Sounds.
And ask your smart speaker
to play BBC Radio 5 Live.
Nikki Campbell.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
I want to speak to Val Stango, Chief Executive of St Mary's Hospice in Cumbria. Good morning, Val.
Good morning.
And Dr. Laura Chapman, Medical Director at Marie Curie Hospice in Liverpool. Good morning, Laura.
Morning, Nikki.
But with every respect to Val and Laura, I'd really like to hear from you. 08085 909 693 and 85058. And Janie has, I know her, she's a wonderful person. And she's, by speaking out, she's given us the chance to talk about this. And it's so important. It's another difficult conversation. And it's one that will inevitably bring in all sorts of issues, carers and caring and home carers and the NHS and hospices and pharmaceuticals, everything, so much. Val, hospices, tell us, I mean, people who work there, amazing. I know that from my own experience, my own father. It must be so difficult for hospices financially to stay afloat. Everyone's suffering. There are challenges for everyone. What are yours, Val?
Difficult to stay afloat. The whole thing about hospices is that we were set up as charitable organisations to be paid partly by the NHS and to raise funds ourselves. And the funds that have come from the state have tended for most hospices to stay static for many, many, many years. So with the rising cost of living, with pay increases, with all of those things, it's become financially harder to deliver a hospice service. But I think we all know hospice services are really quite critical. They're really important when you need them. And we need to find a way out of that financial difficulty.
What is that way out?
I have no magic answer, I have to say. But I think we have to look at the things that hospices do that would end up in hospitals if they weren't done in hospices, and therefore find some money.
Well, this is the argument about home care. Sorry, this is the argument about home carers as well. The home carers save the NHS so much money.
Absolutely. Argument. Absolutely. It's we're all part of a jigsaw, aren't we? The NHS does some really, really, really critical things that we all need, but they should only be doing those things, and we need to find ways to do the other stuff in other places.
Laura Chapman, come in here. What's it like to work in a hospice?
I mean, first of all, thanks for introducing this conversation, because it's something we don't talk about enough in this country.
Well, I thank Janie for being so open about this on going onto social media. I can't say what an amazing person she is enough. And, you know, she's given us the chance to do this. Sorry, Laura, carry on.
Yeah, no, I think it's vital that we're talking about this. So I've been incredibly privileged to work in hospices for about 25 years now. As Val has said, it's an incredibly challenging time in terms of finances. As an organisation, Marie Curie is probably best known for its hospices, but also delivers a whole range of other services as well. And as she said, it's putting that jigsaw together. So hospices are a vital part of that, but also Marie Curie has its hospice care at home, so its nursing service, information and support over the telephone. And then, as you've rightly said, it's actually the families and the informal carers, the people important to the people with a terminal illness, that play a vital role. And we really have to support them. And that's done through counselling and support through the hospices and also out into the community.
I think you've got to be a very special person to work in a hospice. And Ellie's and Ellen as well. And Laura and Val, thank you so much for being a part of this conversation this morning. And likewise, you, Ellie, what would you like to tell us? Hi.
I think I agree, and that it's just absolutely vital that we have these conversations about death and palliative care, because it certainly wasn't something I'd come across prior to my dad's diagnosis and then eventual admittance into a hospice. And advocating for him and visiting him in a hospice was a whole new experience for me. I was 26 at the time, but I feel incredibly privileged that during what was one of the most heartbreaking moments of my life, my dad got to pass away with dignity, and we got to have those conversations. And it just completely changed my outlook on life. And I think hospices do absolutely incredible work.
Changed your outlook on life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It made me, I think, much more able to discuss death instead of treating it as something that might be catching. And instead of just giving that sympathetic head tilt or the automatic I'm so sorry if I learned that a loved one or a friend had lost someone, I was actually able to ask them about that person when appropriate, instead of just shying away from the topic. It also made me more able to have important conversations instead of just skipping over it at risk of feeling uncomfortable. And I would say it made me realise that all we have is the here and the now. And whilst I certainly didn't go on any round-the-world trips, it just made me, I think, that bit more... What's the word? Just that bit more able to identify what really matters, and to advocate for my dad during his palliative care journey.
And how was he as well? I ask you that because I have two friends who are going through this at the moment, very close friends, and I often wonder about that that change of mindset when you realise that it's coming. It's quite a... It's quite... Because, you know, when we're kids and when we grow up, we think we're indestructible and we're going to live forever. It's what Janie said as well. She said, it's devastating news to know that I'm facing the end of life, but we all come to an end sometime. And it is almost... It sounds strange, but it's almost like coming to a realisation that, okay, I'm going... Wherever I'm going, whatever's going to happen, whether it's nothing or whether it's something, it's coming. How was he?
I'd say for him, he was of the older generation, kind of stiff upper lip. And it took him a little while, even when he was visiting the hospice, etc., to really come to that realisation. And then once he did, he was able to have those conversations with us. He asked me directly to do his eulogy. And I remember when I got a phone call from my mum saying, your dad needs you to visit. So I just knew, and he knew. It was kind of like an unspoken conversation between us. I wouldn't say there was huge bouts of emotion like you see in the movies and big proclamations, but we were able to say what really matters. And I think in the moments that I spent sat there just holding his hand, I think it just kind of it said everything in a way. But he was also very specific about his wishes for his funeral, for example. And that was an incredible kindness to us as his family, because it meant we didn't have that continued agony of not only grieving for him, but thinking, would he have liked this? Was this the right hymn choice? He knew exactly how he wanted his funeral to be, where he wanted it to be, how he wanted it to be conducted, right down to the actual funeral directors who came in to visit him and sat with him and spoke about, this is what will happen when you die, this is where your body will be taken, this is what the coffin will look like, this is what the flowers will be like. And I think those conversations, they might sound terribly depressing, but they can actually be really empowering for everyone involved.
I've had a 100% positive experience with funeral directors. They are incredible as well. Mm-hmm. It's the big things that matter. It's the little things as well. I mean, Laura, you'll know this. On the way from the hospital to the hospice, remember, Dad just wanted, he went through around every room in the house. And then particularly the upstairs bathroom, the toilet upstairs, because we just had it decorated. He just wanted to sit in there and enjoy the end result of the day. So it's finding the right words at the right time, Laura, and talking to, you have such sensitivity is required as well about what people believe or what people don't believe as well, Laura.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what Ellie's summed up really beautifully is that holistic support that you get within a hospice. As a doctor, people think that my main focus is going to be on the medicines, on the painkillers, but actually it's wrapping around people and their family with that holistic support. And the things that can make a huge difference is that I think giving them that space to have those open and honest conversations that just create those memories for the rest of the family. But it is when people are approaching the end of their life that they do start to ask those big questions about, sometimes it's why me? It's what does all this mean? It's about what is my value? And that's where, because I'm fortunate enough to work as part of an expert multidisciplinary team, we will call in our chaplain or another member of the team who can actually help support some of those conversations. But I think what Ellie's describing is the lasting impact that has on, you know, her and I should imagine the rest of her family as well.
Mm. Life-changing, as Ellie said. Chris from Uttoxeter. Hello, Chris.
Good morning.
Thank you for coming on. I mean, really, thank you so much. Tell us about the stage that you're at.
Oh, I've got terminal cancer. I've got a few weeks ago, which happened when it happens. So what? I'm not bothered about it. I am not upset about it. I am not angry about it. It's just what it is. So bring it on. It doesn't bother me in the slightest.
Yeah.
I'm a widow. I live on my own. I have no family to arrange the funeral. So you should try to sort it out. Organise it out for yourself. It's hilarious. And my doctor in stitches when I found out. Stuff. I've got to go shopping for a coffin. I've got a very dry sense of humour about it. It's turbulent, it's spread. And I don't know if you know the old Abbott Costello sketch about the baseball. And I
who's
call
on next?
Them,
who's on next?
Yeah, who's on one? No, who's on one? Who's on? What's on two? And I don't know who's on three. Well, that's what they're called. And the gang of bullies. And I'll tell them when I'm ready to go. I've only got a few weeks left. And I'll tell them when I'm ready to go. Until then, they could just be having themselves today. I don't have a problem. I lost my husband to cancer. He died from his diagnosis. They were about to his funeral 3 weeks. And that was a hell of a shock. And I was like, I'd be 46 months, I mean, week 22. So you just get on with it. There's no point in crying and getting angry about it because what can you do? It's cancer and it's gotcha. I can't have chemo and I can't have an op because I've got MS. So just got to get on with it. No point in. I'm just very practical. You just try emptying your own house out and that's. What do you go think? What did I keep in this for you? You know, things that you thought were valuable that don't mean anything. It's just life. You just got very practical. So anybody who knows me is listening to this will say that's Christopher too. I pick the music and I pick the readings. So.
You've picked the music and the readings. Oh, by the way, thank you. I've been doing phone-ins for a long, long time, and that's the first ever mention of Abbott and Costello, specifically Abbott and Costello's Who's On Next sketch. And I want to thank you for that.
It's a giggle. It's you can either tap it two ways. You either get upset about it and get angry about being dodgy terminal, or you could just get on with it. I spoke to you many, many years ago about losing my son to asthma. And that was a shock. And then I lost Jeff 8 years ago to cancer, 3 weeks. And now I've got cancer. So what? Is that a biggie? We've all got to do something in the end.
That's what Janie says as well. And you've organised the music and everything else. And that takes some... You've really thought it through, yeah?
You have to. There's nobody else to do it. So I've got no family. So, so what could you do with it when you're on your own? You've just got to get on with it. There's no point in saying, gnashing your teeth and crying and get upset and sort of thinking, oh God, what do I do with this? At the end of the day, it's just stuff. And stuff doesn't matter. It's people that matter. People you love. And love you who matter, not the things around you, because they're all replaceable. At the end of the day, people that matter, and nothing else really does. It's just everything else is replaceable.
Choosing the music, can I ask?
Well, you can do. I'm having. It's funny. I'm going to have. Those are the Days of Life by Queen, Freddie Mercury. And as I go in, I'm having the sketch to Robert Costello played in. Because most people don't... Well, I've never seen it because they're not in their 60s like I am. And they won't have seen it. So as the coffee goes down to be burned, I'm having that. So it'll start with a chuckle. And it'll end with a chuckle. And the eulogy is my sarcastic sense of humour, and it'll be funny. I don't want people crying. I don't want people roaring with laughter. I don't want people being miserable. Everybody who knows me knows. Well, no, it's me to the T. The reading's me to a T. And I just want people to have a good laugh and to remember the good times and not to be miserable. Because misery loves company.
Misery loves company. Yeah. Mm. That's a wonderful choice. Those were the days of my life, because if Freddie, when he recorded that, knew that the end was coming as well. And
that's right. I've had my time. Let's hope if anybody who's listening to this, if you've got kids or grandkids or children, I haven't got, go home and give them an extra big cuddle and tell them you just love them. Just an extra cuddle from me, because I can't do it. Share the love, Red. Just love people. Because at the end of the day, they're all that matter.
I'm sure they love you so much as well. I'm Laura. Oh. Speak to Chris. What an amazing woman.
Chris, it's amazing hearing just how empowered you are in terms of you've had that opportunity to really make some decisions about what you want and also how you want to be remembered by the people who are important to you. And I think that's incredible.
Oh, don't be daft. I'm just a practical person. I'm not brave or amazing. I'm just me. I've always been down to earth and practical. I'm from the black country. What can you expect? We speak the truth up there. You just get on with it.
And I think it sounds like it's really important to you to have had that control and that opportunity.
Well, I mean, look, I've got cancer. I'm in control of it at the moment. If I decide to say, as I say, I'll call it my bully. And bullies, I'm not going to, you never let a bully win. And I refuse to let this so-and-so bully me until I've done everything I've got to do.
It can have me when
I've done everything I've got to do, but until then this bully can go away.
Great words. A stenographer should write down everything you've said. It's been fantastic. And Chris, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. It really has.
Thank you for listening.
We loved listening to you. Thank you so much.
Oh, damn it. Thank you for listening, Nicky. have a good day.
You're a hilarious woman as well. Thank you, Chris. You have a good day too. And Jeremy in Suffolk as well. What a woman. Hello, Jeremy.
Good morning, Nicky.
Hi. What, Chris, you talk to a fabulous person. Jeremy, you've been through this recently, I believe, after the death of your mum, and I'm so sorry for your loss. End-of-life care, that's what we're talking about this morning. So what would you like to say?
Yeah, so sadly, Nicky, I lost my mum in March of this year. She was diagnosed with sinus cancer in 2019, and that eventually spread into the nerves around her face that ultimately affected her ability to eat and drink and swallow and so on. Mum's wish was to die at home, or should I say remain at home for as long as possible before then being admitted to her local hospice. And as we sort of followed the path of palliative care or end-of-life care, I found it really, really difficult to navigate the care system as it stands today, just to ensure that Mum was ultimately safe within her own home, Nicky. So, for example, I was trying to implement a care plan. So those coming in and out of the house had a clear understanding of Mum's needs, her medical requirements, medication that might have to be taken and so on. But I found that really difficult to implement. And there were so many different carers and professionals involved who, I must say, every individual involved throughout the process were fantastic, but it was the system that I was incredibly frustrated with, because there was no one taking the overarching responsibility to ensure that the care that Mum was receiving was delivered in a sort of holistic way, and that everyone understood their roles and responsibilities.
I think it would be great to bring Val in here with some really, valid thoughts there from Jeremy. Val Stango.
I think Jeremy absolutely has the right of it there. Our system does not work as well as it should. And I think it's back to that thing about the jigsaw. Jigsaws can be really good because they bring the strengths from all different places together. But jigsaws can also be really bad in that if you just give it the slightest nudge, all the bits fall apart. We need something much more comprehensive and cohesive to make sure that everybody gets the chance to die a dignified and peaceful life in whatever way that is that they choose, whether they want to be at home, in a hospice, somewhere else. But at the moment, we have a system of fragments, and that doesn't do the best that it could for people. Jeremy's right.
It's a good phrase, that, isn't it? System of fragments, Jeremy.
Indeed, it is, Nikki. And I think another sort of further bit of insight for you with regards to my experience was the local authority were ultimately responsible for commissioning some of mum's care within the home. And again, the carers were great, but it was a local company that were formed recently as a limited company. The carers that came in had no grasp of mum's care needs. For example, mum needed or required thickened fluids to reduce her risk of asphyxiation, so they weren't aware of that, for example. So it was worrying that, you know, all of this care was so disjointed and it was putting mum's safety at risk.
Going to bring in Tony as well. Jeremy, hugely grateful. Hello, Tony.
Morning, Nikki.
Yeah, and you lost your wife recently.
About
again.
14 months ago, yeah.
So sorry about that. And so many people will know how you're feeling. You never get over it. 14 months is like yesterday, isn't it? So we're talking about end-of-life care. What are your thoughts?
Well, my wife, she was 79, never really in her life. About 7 years, she did have a new aorta heart valve, which was successful. She got on very well. Then she began to, last couple of years, began to develop Parkinson's. She's not too bad at all. But, say, the 14 months ago, she had to go in hospital with a lung problem, another heart problem, a kidney problem. She was really, really struggling in the hospital. She was in the hospital for about 10 weeks, extremely well looked after, but they couldn't do any more. She wasn't strong enough to have any major operations. So then in the end they said, well, we've got to do palliative care, which they took her to another hospital in Leicester. And they were absolutely brilliant in there. They looked after her ever so well. You could visit any time, day or night you wanted to. Offered you dinners, hot meals, cups of tea, anything you wanted. But all the family lived nearby and friends. Many, many visited. I was there, obviously, 7 days. My daughter and my son came. My daughter said, well, you've got to go home, Dad. And she said, I'll stop the night. So then my niece came, and they decided to stop the night. The nurses got them cushions and blankets, and they slept on the floor each side of the bed, which was brilliant. Another night, they took a gin and tonic and a bit of pizza and toasted my wife. And they all said, Janet would really, really have loved this. And that's my experience of palliative care, which with friends and family and the hospitals was absolutely brilliant. It couldn't have been better.
And Janet was, she was comfortable there. It was all.
Oh yes, yes.
I nearly said happy, and I thought, oh, no, that's the wrong thing to say. But do you know what I mean?
Well, there was always two or three visitors together, family and friends, and obviously sitting there for hours, and you start to talk about memories of when they were kids and when we were younger, and they're making each other laugh. Do you remember this? Do you remember that? Which I thought was very, very good.
Nobody could manage on your own. You just couldn't manage on your own. But if you've got a good friends and a family, it's a great help.
Mm. Laura, that's all good to know, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really heartening to hear that Tony and Janet's experience of end-of-life care in a hospital was a positive one. I think, unfortunately, that's not always the case just because of how stretched hospitals are. And we do try to do whatever we can to keep people at home for as long as possible. But yeah, absolutely, very positive story there from Tony.
And thank you so much for all your texts. Tony, take care. Thanks for getting in touch. Unless there's anything else you want to say, you can say it.
No, it's quite all right. Thank you very much. Thank you.
All right. You'd said it all. Thank you very much. Yeah. Cheers now. Bye-bye. Let me come to some text. Talking about end-of-life care. And thank you for all of these this morning. Let me see now. Let's just get the console up. A lot of reaction to Chris in Uttoxeter. Amazing caller. Don't be daft, unquote, laughing and crying at the same time. That comes from Tim. This, I'm an occupational therapist in the community and cover services across three county borders. Support received in the community varies depending on local charities that provide end-of-life care. If you live in an area with one of those fantastic teams that are run by nurses, the support received is so much more than in areas not covered by one of those teams. It makes such a difference for both the individual and their families. Getting appropriate care provision is also a really important factor, as without this, families really struggle to manage and their loved ones end up being admitted to hospital unnecessarily. And another text. My husband died in March of cancer. We had some support from the hospice, but my husband chose to die at home and I gave the care. It was very difficult. That's from Liz. I nearly said government there for some, and maybe it came into my mind, overall arching responsibility. What do we do? How do we make it better? But thank you very much for that text. This one. My husband died in March of cancer. Sorry, I've just read that one. It's all a bit much. This one. Nikki, 2 years ago, I got a call from my sick dad to say he'd been told by his consultant that he had 2 weeks to live. He ended up living for more than 3 more months, going into a wonderful hospice, St. Peter's and St. James in East Sussex. He actually was sent home after a couple of weeks the first time. They managed to stabilise him and get his pain relief right. After 6 weeks at home, he deteriorated and went back in. The staff were incredible. And it was actually a joyful place to be, despite what we all knew was coming. My mum, my brother and I were with him as he breathed his last breath and felt his last heartbeat. It was an incredible privilege. And the care that he and the family got was just amazing. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for all of those. It's 10:33, very nearly.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
And here is the news from Dina Campbell.
Thank you, Nikki. Benjamin Netanyahu has ordered his army to continue fighting with full force. That's despite calls from some Western and Arab nations for a 3-week ceasefire in Israel's fight with Lebanese armed group Hezbollah. The office for Israel's prime minister says he has not responded to last night's ceasefire plea. An 18-year-old has been charged with the murder of 15-year-old Dejean Campbell, who was found stabbed in Woolwich in southeast London on Sunday. Jacob Loshevich is due to appear in court this morning. British Transport Police have begun an investigation after a cyber attack hit public Wi-Fi at some of the biggest railway stations in the country. Network Rail says 20 locations were targeted. It's understood that customer data wasn't compromised. And scientists say Earth is about to get a second moon this weekend. A small asteroid is going to be captured by Earth's gravitational pull and temporarily become a mini moon. It'll be around from September 29th for a couple of months before escaping from Earth's gravity again. Now, don't expect to see it with the naked eye. You'll need a professional telescope to see it. Katie Smith's here with your sport.
Manchester United boss Erik Ten Hag says he'll have to look in the mirror after a disappointing 1-1 draw with his former club Twente. It was in their Europa League opener last night and the action continues later. Spurs host Carabag while Rangers go to Malmo. Meanwhile, it's crunch time for Arsenal women in Champions League qualifying. They're 1-0 down to Hecken going into their second leg at home tonight. We'll have reporters at all the key matches for you in Five Live Sport from 7. Elsewhere, Britain's Jack Draper is through to the Japan Open last 16. Following a straight sets win over Mattia Bellucci. It's his first victory since defeat at the hands of Yannick Sinner in the US Open semi-finals earlier this month. And Mark Selby, John Higgins and reigning world champion Kyron Wilson all progressed at the British Open snooker yesterday. World number one Judd Trump faces fellow Englishman Mark Davis later in Cheltenham as he bids to make the 1,000th century break of his career. Only Ronnie O'Sullivan and Higgins have reached that mark previously.
This weekend on BBC Radio 5 Live.
On Sunday, Manchester United take on Spurs on 5 Live Premier League Sunday.
And the ball does find its way to the back of the net.
And on Saturday, there's updates from around the grounds, as well as live commentary of Arsenal versus Leicester at 3 and Wolves versus Liverpool at 5:30.
Tees it up, left foot, oh, he scored!
5 Live Sports.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
On digital radio.
On BBC Sounds.
And ask your smart speaker
to play BBC Radio 5 Live.
Nikki Campbell.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
850-58 and call us on 08085 909693. We're talking about end-of-life care. Val is with us. Val Stango, Chief Executive at St Mary's Hospice in Cumbria. And Dr. Laura Chapman, Medical Director at Marie Curie Hospice in Liverpool. We're talking about this because of the phenomenal and fantastic comedian and human being, Janie Godley, who's announced on social media she's now going into end-of-life care. And David in Cambridge, not real name. Hello, David. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Okay.
I'm sorry about your recent loss, but listen, this is your chance to say what you need to say.
Yeah, so it was I lost my mum, and the part I wanted to talk about was the end of life, the very end of life care. We received amazing personal care by the staff, I was with mum over the last 2 weeks. Like, we'd slept and stayed there constantly, and water and fluids and food are withdrawn, there's a process at the very end of life, and I would sit at night watching the morphine sort of plunger going down slowly, and this went on for 2 weeks, and it was really brutal to watch, because the decision has been made. There was no further, nothing else they could sadly do, everything had been withdrawn, and it just felt very, very drawn out. And although mum was peaceful, and we couldn't dampen her moisten her lips. Yeah, it was a very difficult process to go through, and it felt somewhat unnecessary. So much is I'm old enough to remember Harold Shipman, and I understand the delicacies and the need for care and such.
Proper oversight, accountability.
Exactly. But just through the night, watching mum deteriorate, and just I would look at this little plunger and see the little readings, given its mils per hour or whatever, and it's locked away in a box, obviously, and the nurse would come in and change it. And, yes, it was brutal to watch.
I mean, Laura, come in here. That's speak to David, not real name. Brutal to watch. So tough, so hard, so difficult, Laura.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that story, David. And I can hear from your voice just how painful this still is for you, and I'm sorry to hear that. And end of life, so when we're talking about the last hours or days of somebody's life, is so variable. Mm. And yeah, it's I think it's incredibly hard on family, sitting there just being present in the moment and sitting with somebody.
It's 12 days.
Yeah, and that's incredibly hard, isn't it, for all of you, and it's clearly taken a toll. I think some of the things you mentioned that are really difficult are around the food and fluids. And certainly we're really careful to individualize that. So I think if somebody is awake enough and able to have a little bit to eat and drink, they can. But it's one of those.
Yeah, my mum had gone in for a stroke, so she'd had a stroke, and unfortunately she caught COVID, which developed into pneumonia while she was on in hospital, and it was the pneumonia that actually was the cause of death. Yeah.
And it's incredibly hard, isn't it? And it's weighing up on a daily or even an hourly basis. What is the right treatment to give this person at this time, both in terms of the medications?
That's right. Whether it was they were trying to deal with the seizures that were continuing after the stroke, or the pneumonia, and the different teams that luckily she was in one place in a hospital. So the coordination was able to be better. But yes, there's teams to this and teams to that, and you know, wanting to try and deal with this, and it's a multifaceted approach. I do understand that.
It is.
Well, David, there's a text in on that. We addressed this earlier on. From Deb in Swiss Cottage, saying, North London, saying, we recently experienced end-of-life care. The numerous teams involved didn't communicate with each other. That was...
I wouldn't want to criticise any of the staff, because they were nothing but accommodating and caring and everything you could want. I wouldn't want to criticise that. But yes, there is so many different lines to the care, or particularly in Mum's case.
Well, as Laura said, thank you so much for sharing your story, David. Thank you.
No problem. I always enjoy the show, and you do a great job.
But
I just wanted to highlight that. This very end of life care that could be helped better, I would hope.
You've done the nation a great service by coming on and giving us your contribution and giving us your thoughts. That is the truth. Mark in King's Lynn. Hello, Mark. You've had two very recent experiences, parents dying. Again, I'm so sorry for your loss. What were those experiences like? Am I seeing here from your text there was a lack of coordination of care, which echoes quite a lot of the stuff, and it was something, to be fair, that, as I mentioned, Laura and Val were talking about earlier on in the text we just had. Is that the burden of your song, as it were?
Yes, it is, Nicky. Thanks for having me on. It's very rare that I've actually taken the opportunity to voice my opinions, but I feel very strongly about this. And it's absolutely not about talking about the individuals involved, because I think everyone involved in the care of my mother-in-law, who passed in 2022 from cancer, and my father, who passed July this year, also from cancer, I think the care from the individuals who want to do a great job was second to none. But however, as echoing your other callers, the coordination between services, and we're talking about two very remotely different parts of the country, one in the south of England and one in the east of England, so different authorities and charities involved, shared equal breakdowns in communication between whether it be in home help, social care, hospice care, and indeed hospital care itself.
Yeah, Laura, I spoke to you just a second ago, so forgive me, I'll bring Val in on this one to talk to Mark.
Yeah, I think Mark's right that we know that often communication is the place where things fall down, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It's that thing where you have different organisations, each behind their own glass wall, maybe absolutely perfectly working in each organisation, but there's something about how we weave across to have people in different organisations recognising and speaking to each other that doesn't always work perfectly. And I think that happens all the way through life, but at end of life, you have what we call one chance to get it right. And if it's not got right in that small window of opportunity, it feels burdensome for the people left behind. So it is really important that we get it right and we work together well as local organisations. And I guess I feel an urge to apologise on behalf of all of us who get it wrong sometimes, because none of us want people to have that experience.
Is that leadership, different leaderships in different places, obviously different leadership styles, different leadership capabilities and abilities, for sure.
I think it can also be that, this is not meant to sound like an excuse, I think it can also be that organisations are busy and everybody is trying to do their bit that they've got in front of them as well as they can. But it is really important to talk to the person in the other service you're working alongside too. But that can be seen as just an extra task, or it can be a tricky task if you can't get the right person, or it adds time to your day. And none of that is meant to sound like an excuse, because it shouldn't be like that.
No, but it shouldn't be down to the family or the patients themselves to have to relay the situation every time somebody else comes to provide a certain element of care. And that's exactly what we found, that it was definitely left hand, right hand, not knowing what each other was doing. But it's then putting the extra pressure on the family or on the patient themselves, to feel like they've got to remember everything that's going on and who said what and who came. And it's like retelling the story every time someone different came to the house.
It absolutely shouldn't be like that. What a
thing to have to go through. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and twice in 2 years is just, bordering on bad luck. But it's unfortunate that the geographically remote locations in both cases were absolutely mirrored. In the fact that there was no facility for my mother-in-law or my father to go into the hospice. And the first occasion in the south of England, the hospice was full, which we understand. We had care at home, but we weren't aware that she was about to pass until probably the 2 days beforehand, when a hospice nurse just dropped it into conversation that the end was that close, because we hadn't been sort of made aware of that and it didn't present like that. And in the second, in the east of England, in the second occasion with my father, they had beds at the hospice, but they were underfunded, so they weren't able to staff those beds, so couldn't even provide respite care. And he ended up having to go into a hospital. And this was organised by one very, very helpful cancer nurse at the big hospital in the east of England, who took it upon herself to actually, you know, pull some strings and get things moving. So again, it shouldn't really be down to an individual to take that on themselves.
Thank you, Mark. And there's a text here which is responding to David's call earlier on. David, not real name, who lost his mum recently and spoke about what was his word, the brutal experience. And this text says, I feel so much for the call of David and his pain. But as a nurse of over 40 years with many of those spent in palliative care, watching your loved ones die is brutal. However, fluids and food is not withdrawn, but the body shuts down as part of the dying process. In my experience, dying can take many days, and it's positively dangerous to give semi and unconscious patients fluids. It's sad that this info is not imparted by the professionals to your caller, as many relatives get so hooked into the fluid diet debate. Chris in Arundel. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Nicky.
Thanks for coming on. What would you like to say?
Well, I guess really I just wanted to sort of share a little bit of my experience, both, you know, the circumstances of the situation. So followed on from that. So I was diagnosed with a GBA, a glioblastoma, July 22, undertook emergency cranial awake surgery in King's College in London, which through a guy there, an incredible surgeon, Dr. Jose Labrador, who performed a minor miracle. Ultimately, GVAs are a real struggle because they basically give you very little chance of survival. So you're looking at, you know, 11 to 12 months maximum term, even despite having surgery. I underwent secondary surgery again in an attempt to improve that situation, but unfortunately that wasn't possible. And I guess really from the sort of experience that I wanted to describe is what that then moves to. So you start to obviously move towards a palliative care stage, having had a course of radio and chemo treatment, etc., all designed to try and slow down the effects of the tumour growth. I'm still sort of managing that reasonably well, given the circumstances. But you move on to a secondary phase of the care side of things when palliative teams sort of step in. I mean, I can really only speak from what has just been nothing short of a fantastic experience, both through the surgical procedures that I mentioned and then obviously the palliative hospice care type of things where they came and visited me in Chichester and talked you through the process of, you know, talking about death and bringing the family together and going through, you know, the hard yards, which is obviously for anyone to talk about death is incredibly hard. But a necessary purpose to prepare you for that. So, you know, my experience really throughout all these stages has been fantastic. I've got a team of people that come out and look after me. Obviously, I get the chance to see my three beautiful grown-up kids and my beautiful wife. And we all know that, you know, we've got some good days ahead and some bad, but living through that experience is whilst challenging, is the best that you can do. And as I say, I can only speak to an incredible process that I've been through with a lot of amazing people.
And how are the family?
The family are they're good. They're, I mean, obviously that stage of things coming to terms with that for the family is very difficult. And in some ways, I would say it's kind of almost a slightly hidden experience in that you can have those chats with, you know, with your grown-ups. But you know, we've had the odd collective discussion because we've had to talk about death. We've had to talk about what the funeral looks like and trying to make the most of that type of experience, you know, is obviously very, very hard when you never consider that it would ever happen. But
yeah.
But it's, again, I think overall I've been very, very fortunate with the support that I've had throughout that journey. And I'm still fighting. The key thing is to keep on fighting mentally. So, you know, meditative work and doing things all designed to try and slow this growth because you want to keep going as long as possible. I've got I'm expecting my first grandchild in October. So, yeah, that mental focus on that is hugely important. So,
oh, that's fantastic. That's coming up. When you're dealing with the, and you're saying all this so brilliantly, when you're dealing with the practical stuff, the insurance policies, the future, the all that stuff, is that a useful distraction or is that actually at the heart of the agony, mental agony? Which is it?
I would say it goes in stages. I think you get, for the majority of the time, trying to handle some of those things, the here and the now, you know, stupid things like, oh, there's a tax return that you need to get done. You know, all the stuff like that sometimes that's actually quite difficult to get involved in, because part of you mentally starts to say, well, to hell with that. I just want to focus on staying as long as I can. Why should I care about these things? So those are often challenges. But that, and in many ways, the stress that comes from that is very often something that you find, like my wife, will get maybe slightly tetchy about certain things like that, because you know, she wants to know that as much is done as possible, that everybody, you know, we're all sorted, and there's nothing else for them to worry about. So I think that is certainly a challenging aspect of these things.
So good that you got in touch with us, Chris. Thank you. Enjoy the grandchild, the first grandchild. My goodness
Thank
me, what excitement. What must that be like? Grandchild? Oh, yeah. What's that? What's that thing? Is it your son or daughter must be so, such a positive in your family. It's a great thing to have that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think those are the things that I would encourage everyone to grasp at.
Mm. Thank you so much, Chris. Thank you.
Great to talk to you.
Great talking to you, great, really. And Shelley in Swindon. Hello, Shelley.
Hello, Nikki. How are you?
Very well. And you worked in a hospice. Wow. What was that like?
I do work.
You do work in one. Even better. What's it like? Oh, we've just dropped the line. We'll get her back as soon as possible. That was we've had incredible calls this morning, Val, haven't we? And have we got Shelley back yet? No, we're getting her. Sorry, I'm getting voices in my head. Story of my life. So Val, what a call there that we just had. The positives are from Chris. We should all live every day as it comes, you know, but that attitude, you know, keeping you going, the grandchild coming up, inspiring.
It is. And I think that is the core of hospice life, of the hospice message, is keep on living until you're dead. There is no value in letting yourself die or shut down early. We do everything that we can to support people in living their life as much as they can right up until the end, whether that's dealing with physical symptoms like Laura does, or the emotional fallout, supporting the family, talking about bereavement before death has even happened. It's all about trying to support people to live right in the middle of their lives until the moment that it ends, because
until
we will
moment,
all
yeah.
end up there.
Mm-hmm.
And it, there is no value in stopping early. Keep going. Let's make it as good as it can be. Let's enjoy the small things, like your callers have said. Let's keep smelling the coffee.
Let's remember,
loving
the coffee,
family.
Loving the family, and remember what really matters, because you know what they say, everyone in the graveyard votes the same. We've got Shelley back. Shelley.
Sorry, I'm so excited to talk to you.
I'm so excited to talk to you because we've only got a couple of minutes. You work in a hospice.
Let's do it.
Why?
I work at Prospect Hospice in Swindon. And I worked in corporate before that, where I felt I could just do a bit more. My mum died at Rowcroft Hospice in Devon. And when I saw the job advertised at Prospect Hospice, I just knew that I had to work there. Hospices are the most amazing places. The people that work there are just inspirational. Part of my job is to actually talk to people who are about to die. And it's such a privilege to be able to hear their life stories. And lots of them are at peace. They've kind of had those conversations that we've been talking about today. They've put their affairs in order. They've had the time, which they don't usually get in a hospital, to have those conversations with their loved ones around them. And it's just a great place to die, if there is such a thing.
Yeah, yeah. What a phrase. Do you love your work?
Yeah, every day I go into work and I enjoy it. There's so much laughter, positive. I think when you work at a hospice, you just realise that every day counts, like everyone has said today on the phone in. Every day counts, that you see the joy in the small things and you realise that everyone dies and you start having those conversations that you might not have had before, and you don't say passing, you don't say they pop their clogs, you don't say they're pushing up roses, you say die, because everyone does die and everyone needs to have those really important conversations, and that's what hospices do. They give you that, they enable you to be able to have those conversations and have your loved ones around you when you do die.
You're amazing. Thank you. And thanks to everybody this morning. And to Val Stango and Dr. Laura Chapman.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 11 o'clock. This is Adam Porter. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has dismissed calls for a ceasefire with Hezbollah in Lebanon. His office said the proposal was an idea put forward by America and France, which he hadn't responded to. He added that he'd ordered the army to continue the fighting with full force. Our Middle East correspondent Hugo Bachega, who's in Beirut, says it's unlikely Hezbollah would accept a ceasefire either.
Here in Lebanon, Hezbollah has remained defiant. The group says these attacks on Israel are going to continue, that this is, in solidarity with the Palestinian population of Gaza, and that the attacks are going to continue unless there is a ceasefire in Gaza. So it's very difficult to see how they're going to agree with the deal without a ceasefire in Gaza.
Elon Musk has given a scathing response on X after the BBC revealed he hadn't been invited to the government's International Investment Summit next month. Mr. Musk said he didn't think anyone should go to the UK when they were releasing convicted paedophiles in order to imprison people for social media posts. He didn't cite any evidence for his claim. Sources say he wasn't invited because of his social media posts during the recent riots. The BBC has heard harrowing testimony from a woman who said she was raped by the former owner of Harrods, Mohammed Al-Fayed, when she was 16, after being made to have intrusive medical examinations. The woman said they were arranged for her with Dr. Anne Coxon, who hasn't replied to the BBC's request for comment. Harrods' new owners have previously apologised unreservedly for the actions of Mohammed Al-Fayed. Mike Radford is the executive producer of the BBC documentary, which aired the claims against the former tycoon.
This is the first time she's spoken openly, and we can report what she said. We've been in contact with her for a number of months during the making of the documentary. But like many survivors, speaking publicly is, as you can imagine, a huge step. These are the most traumatic experiences for them, whose consequences reverberate for decades afterwards. And as a result, many are understandably reticent.
An 18-year-old is due to appear in court this morning charged with the murder of a 15-year-old boy in Woolwich in southeast London. Jacob Loshevich is accused of killing Dejuan Campbell.